Good evening and welcome. I'm Conservator David Ferriero, and during the day, I'm the Andrew W. Mellon Director of the New York Public Libraries, and it's my real pleasure to welcome you here tonight to our Conservators event, the second in the fall series. On behalf of the Council of Conservators, I'm happy that you're here tonight to enjoy this timely program, but more importantly, that you're here supporting the mission of the New York Public Library. The Conservators program raises funds to support the general operating expenses of the library. That means making a gift of $1,500 or more to our annual fund. You provide crucial support for the library's collections, services, staffing, preservation, cataloging, and providing access to the wonderful world of information, both in print and in digital formats, and support for our highly trained staff who helps our users use this information. And in appreciation, our donors receive exclusive access to the New York Public Library, including programs like tonight. I'd like to make a special welcome to the guests of Conservators, what I would call our future Conservators, and urge you on your way out to pick up the information about membership, to join the family, and become Conservators and get your own invitations to events. And if you have any information, any questions about what it entails and what you're in for, I'll be happy to answer questions, as will anyone here who is a Conservator. I need to acknowledge a Conservator who I don't think has arrived yet, but John Oates, one of our wonderful Conservators, is the genius behind tonight's program. This was his idea. And I'm sure by the end of the evening, you'll agree with me, an incredibly stimulating idea, and we all owe a debt of gratitude to John. And now it's my pleasure to introduce tonight's moderator, Jim Atlas. Jim is a biographer, a publisher, and I want to point out, Jim didn't know this, but I want to point out an important book that Jim has published. It's called A Universal History of the Destruction of Books. This is not fiction. This is real. This is the story of the destruction of cultures by the destruction of libraries through history. And it is a good example of the fragility of libraries. And I recommend it to you, all of you in the audience, as a reminder of what libraries are all about. So, Jim?
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. I wish I'd known you were going to say that. I would have had copies of my book for sale out there, too. this is a very easy assignment. You all know why you're here. This isn't one of these evenings where I have to say that Robert Caro won this prize and that prize, and that Ted Sorensen served on this staff and wrote that book. I mean, these are men who are legends, and it's a very good mix, if I may say so, that we came up with Susan Morgenthau and John Oakes, because you have the biographer and. I will say this about, can I call you Bob? No, I've known him for decades. I'm just trying to be Sarah Palin with Joe Biden. No, I've known him for decades, and I've been reading his biography for decades and hope to read it for decades more. You know, Dr. Johnson said of Milton's Paradise Lost, none would wish it longer. Well, this is true of virtually every biography I have ever read, except Boswell's Johnson and Caro's LBJ, which I want to continue to be as long as he needs it to be. And volume 4 will be out, he claims, in 2 years. I know how biographers work, so don't get your expectations too high. But and Ted Sorensen, I highly recommend that you read Counselor. It's a book that is not only about history and how history is made, but how the words that made history were made. I'm sure you're familiar with Ted Sorensen is too self-effacing to acknowledge how much, shall we say, assistance and he gave to JFK in the writing of some of his world-transforming speeches and phrases. But I was very struck by the fact that that LBJ was so jealous of your talents. It was sort of like you wrote so well for JFK. Why couldn't you write such this beautiful words for me too? And we have Bob Clark, the supervisory archivist of the FDR Library in Hyde Park, and he is the one who sits behind the librarian's desk and decides who has access to the words that Ted Sorensen supervised or was present at the writing of, and who interpreted those words, the decipherer, and how they get where they are. So it's a very good program. I'm very proud to be here. My dear friend Joan Bingham, who's in the audience, said that what I should mostly do is just sit back and let them tell stories. And that's very good advice, and that is, in effect, what I'm going to do. I want Bob to sort of, he's worked in these archives for so many decades, and there are so many millions of papers that he's grappled with over these decades. I want him to describe for us what it's like to walk into this presidential library and be confronted with this massive archive of a lifetime, and to tell us just maybe one story about one document that has changed the way he views his subject and his interpretation of it.
Well, when you walk into the Johnson Library, which is a huge building in Austin, Texas, the ground floor is a museum. And then you walk through it and you turn a corner and in front of you is this broad, high marble staircase. And at the top of it is a wall of glass, four stories high. And what you see are four stories of red boxes covered in red buckram, stamped with a presidential steel seal and 24-karat gold. And those boxes go back for four floors about the length of a football field. The only time I ever felt like not doing this book was the moment you mentioned the first time I walked into the Johnson Library. What's one thing I can tell you? Well, we all know Lyndon Johnson is a political genius at wielding national power. I'll tell you about how I found out how he got national power. Because if you spend enough time with these boxes, if you love politics, government, as I do, there's almost nothing you can't learn there. When I was going through the papers, when Johnson was a congressman, because it's got all the papers for his entire career, congressman, senator, and vice president, and president, you suddenly see a change of tone in the letters. And it happens in a single month, October 1940. Before that month, he's a very junior congressman. He's 32 years old, and he's writing the letters you would expect a junior congressman to write to senior committee chairman. Can I have a few moments of your time? After Election Day, which was November 2nd, 1940, suddenly the letters are coming to him from the committee chairman. Lyndon, can I have a few moments of your time? So what happened in that month? Well, I actually had been told in my interviews what happened in that month, that Johnson, who after all was a political genius, realized that young as he was and junior though he was, he possessed something that no other congressman had. He was the only one who knew two groups of people, the Texas oilmen and contractors who wanted favors from the federal government, the oil depletion allowance, federal contracts, etc. They were reactionaries, they were conservatives, but they were willing to give money to get these favors, and in the form of campaign contributions. And on the other side, he knew all the Northeastern congressmen, liberals, who were running in 1940 and needed campaign contributions. And I had been told that Johnson made himself, told the oil men, only give through me. I'll distribute the money, and I'll get you the government legislation that you want. But they said, you know, you're never going to be able to write about that kid. This was so long ago that they called me kid. You're never
going to... You're still kid.
You're never going to be able to write about this kid because you're never going to be able to document it. And, of course, they were right. If I couldn't prove it in black and white, I couldn't write something like that. And then one day, while I was looking through all these boxes of the House of Representatives papers, suddenly in front of me, there was a telegram dated October 3rd, 1940, from George Brown, who was the president of Brown and Root, it's now Halliburton Brown and Root, saying, Lyndon, the checks are on their way. And not far from it, in that same box, you know, you sit there in this reading room, in the center of all these boxes, and you call for whatever boxes, you fill out a slip, and you call for whatever box you want delivered. And I called for it in this box. Suddenly, near that telegram was the following thing, which I'll take just a moment to tell you about, because it's such a remarkable document. There are four typed sheets of paper. Each of the sheets of paper has three typed columns. They're typed by John Connolly, who is then Lyndon Johnson's assistant. The first column is the name of the congressman who's asking for money. The second column is why is the amount that he wants, and the amounts are so small then, $1,000, $1,500. The third column is why they need it, and it's pleading, it's desperation, it's a month before the election. Lyndon, if I can just have one more round of ads, I can pull this out. Lyndon, they're trying to steal it at the polls. We need money for poll watches. And then in the left-hand column is Lyndon Johnson's handwriting on these four sheets of paper next to each name. If he gives them the amount that they want, he writes, okay. If he gives them part of it, let's say they've asked for $1,500 and he's giving them $1,000, it's okay, $1,000. But sometimes he writes no, which means he's not giving them money, and sometimes he writes no out. And I asked John Connolly, what did it mean if Lyndon Johnson wrote no out? And Connolly said that meant that they were never getting any money. If you crossed Lyndon Johnson, he never forgot. So that's an example of the kind of thing you can find.
Well, and this is why when I was reading Counselor, I had a biographer's nightmare. He says he reveals that he didn't keep notes, that Ted Sorensen didn't keep notes during these momentous days in history, and as you said, you've been biographers and historians have no doubt lamented this. We can never have too many documents, and maybe some congressmen have too. But I wondered as I was reading it, how did you assemble this book, which is so vivid and tells you so much on a day-to-day basis, without having had taken extensive notes?
Well, thanks very much. Let me begin by saying there are two heroes in my book, John F. Kennedy and my father. And my father was elected Attorney General of Nebraska the year I was born and told me some years later of the time that he was invited to address at the state penitentiary as Attorney General, the Sunday morning chapel service. And he got up there a little bit as I look about today, and he did not know how to begin. He couldn't say my friends. He didn't know any of them. If he said fellow citizens, that would have been rubbing in a little bit that he had taken away some of their citizenship rights. Ladies and gentlemen would have been a stretch. So finally he just said, I'm glad to see so many of you here.
I must remember that.
which is the way I wanted to begin this evening. My book was made possible through three presidential libraries, which is why I'm a strong believer in the presidential library system. Of course, I also drew upon my own files, my sister's family files, my father's files in the Nebraska State Historical Society, but I also found the files of the Kennedy Library, not only my own, but to the extent they were available to me, the oral history files of all my colleagues in the White House and government. My young assistant, who, because I don't see very well, did a lot of research for me, went to the LBJ Library and found they were extremely helpful in making available to him some of LBJ's vice presidential files in particular. And because of a particular incident about my father on which I needed more information that had never been available to the family, I took a chance that there might be information in the Franklin Roosevelt library, FDR library, and lo and behold, it turns out it was Robert Clark who helped me. I only realized that when I met him tonight. But my father had long been a friend, political supporter, even campaign manager of one of the great Nebraska senators, George W. Norris. And Norris, in 1941, when the vacancy appeared at the federal district court in Lincoln, Nebraska, told, and he was in a position to tell, FDR that the man for that post was C.A. Sorensen in Nebraska. Time passed, and no nomination ever took place. And it turned out, and information in the FDR library helped confirm this, that the Democrats of Nebraska did not like my father, partly because he had been attorney general on the insurgent Republican ticket. Republicans didn't like him either. And partly because he was a Unitarian, which I talk about at some length in the state. And ironically, it was the Irish Catholics who ran the Democratic Party in Nebraska who called in an FDR administrative assistant and demanded that Sorensen not get the post. And much of this is reflected in correspondence between Roosevelt and his attorney general, Francis Biddle, at the time that all this was happening. It was right before and after Pearl Harbor. You would have thought the President of the United States would have more important things on his mind, but that is what he and Biddle were talking about at the time. So I'm grateful to that library as well. I should mention my mother, who was a great believer in libraries, in the public library. As I tell in the book, my mother and her five children every Saturday made a trip to the Lincoln, Nebraska Public Library carrying a bushel basket. And we would each pick out the books we wanted to read that week, fill up the bushel basket, take it home that afternoon, and the following week bring it back with those books to return and get another bushel basket full. So much of what I learned as a young person I owe to the Lincoln Public Library. And when the American Library Association representative came to the White House to meet President Kennedy in 1961, I inserted myself into that meeting in order to let that representative know how much libraries meant to me, and they still do. But there's one other presidential library, in a sense. Most people are not even aware of it. And that is the Jefferson Library, which, in a sense, was the first Library of Congress. The National Library burned down. I just don't know whether it was the War of 1812 or earlier, but that library had been what everyone had depended upon, and Thomas Jefferson donated his personal library to the country, to the government. And that library, I understand, was divided into three parts, which one he labeled memory, which I assume was history, One he labeled reason, which I assume was policy, philosophy, politics. And the third he called imagination. I have to assume that was fiction. And I have said to some audiences, I think my book reflects all three. Memory, because it's the history of my growing up in Lincoln, Nebraska, my education, the development of my ideas and conscience. My book is the history of my 11 years as a Kennedy and my years as an international lawyer since. It contains reason because I talk about my background in Unitarianism, my philosophy, my politics, my idealism, which I inherited from my parents. And it has fiction, it has imagination, not in the sense of fiction, I don't believe, but it has imagination because a lot of what my parents taught me and what John F. Kennedy, who was a real mentor to me, taught me, is what this country could be and should be. And that takes imagination, and it's imagination that drives this country forward, and I believe very strongly is going to drive us forward in the next 4 or 8 years after the upcoming election. So I'll conclude by reading, if I may, if the light is strong enough here, from my favorite page in the book. I believe you'll find it in the section near the end of part two. Part two is about Kennedy, my years, 11 years with Kennedy. And near the end, there's a chapter on Kennedy's foreign policy. And I talk about his single greatest speech. His single greatest speech was not the inaugural. It was not West Berlin. It was not even the speech on national television about civil rights, which was one of his greatest. No, it was his commencement address at American University on June 10, 1963. And let me see if I can read this. I'll try to read it quickly, half a page. That spring and summer formed a remarkably intensive but productive period in Kennedy's curtailed presidency. On the day before the American University speech, June 9, he spoke to the nation's mayors in Honolulu, calling for their help on the civil rights crisis. On June 10, the same day that he spoke at American University, he also signed the Equal Pay Act prohibiting wage discrimination against women. The next day, June 11, he directed from the Oval Office the admission of the University of Alabama's first two black students, despite Governor George C. Wallace's theatrically staged stand in the doorway, and went on nationwide television to give the strongest presidential declaration since Abraham Lincoln that race discrimination in this country was to end permanently. The next day, June 12, he established the first National Advisory Council on the Arts. 1 week later, he sent Congress the most comprehensive civil rights legislation of all time, announced the joint U.S.-Soviet establishment of a direct communications link between our respective capitals, the so-called hotline. By June 23rd, he was in Germany on his trip to solidify the Western Alliance. To paraphrase Wordsworth, bliss was it in that dawn to be alive, but to be young and in the service of that president was very heaven.
Thank you, Tad.
I'm glad you mentioned this huge, momentous event that looms over us in the next 2 weeks, and which provides a wonderful frame for the evening. As I listen to speeches and as I see this process unfold, I always think of it from the perspective of a historian or a biographer. How will these events be recorded? How much will we know of them? What will survive? And Bob Clark, who's Bob Clark is the one who knows about libraries. And so I've asked him to tell us a little bit about the creation of the first presidential library, how the idea of presidential libraries came about. And also, though I don't want to get mired in politics, I'm interested in the way the Bush administration views the whole idea of access to papers and how perhaps future generations will address the same key matter that has so much to do with how history gets written.
Thanks, Jim. FDR called the dedication of the library an act of faith, and I think it's appropriate that you just published a book on the destruction of libraries, because when the FDR library was dedicated in June of 1941, remember what was happening around the world. Germany had just invaded the Soviet Union within the space of a few months. Democracies were being crushed around the world. And here's the President of the United States doing something very, very publicly. He's dedicating the first presidential library in the nation that will ensure that the papers of his administration and the records of its government are preserved for all time and accessible to the American people. I'm going to correct one thing that you said when you were introducing me, which is I don't decide who has access to those archives. I work for you all. The papers that are in a presidential library belong to the people of the United States. My job is to be an administrator for you and a protector for you and to help preserve the nation's record. And that's a job that archivists take very, very seriously. We're there to serve all to the best of our ability and to ensure that those documents are not just here for Mr. Sorensen to access or for Mr. Caro to access, but to ensure that they're here for hundreds of years beyond all of us. Before FDR was president of the United States, there was no system set in place to preserve presidential papers. In fact, until Richard Nixon left office in disgrace in 1974, presidential papers were deemed to be the property of the president, and they could take them with them when they left office and do whatever they wanted to with them. That led to the loss of some of America's great historical record. Certain stories come to mind. If you think politics is nasty now, imagine what it was like, or remember what it was like in the 19th century. Chester Arthur, the day before he died, literally put his papers in three trash bins and burned them all so that they would not be used politically against his family. Robert Todd Lincoln dispersed many of Abraham Lincoln's papers as he was an up-and-comer in the Pullman Railroad Car Company. Zachary Taylor's papers were actually in the basement of a nephew of his in Louisiana, and when Sherman did the March to the Sea, that house was burned down and Zachary Taylor's papers were lost. Ulysses S. Grant, who we all know had trouble keeping track of who his friends were, certainly couldn't keep track of his papers. And also at that time, there was no presidential pension. And so, presidents often left office destitute, and so in order to make money for their families, they often had to sell their papers. But then you get into the situation where an outgoing president, the incoming Congress is not particularly friendly. Are they going to appropriate funds to purchase the papers of a president to place at the Library of Congress like Jefferson did? That was unlikely. So you saw these terrible stories happen and the loss of the great American written heritage. FDR, in the middle of his second term, when he was looking towards retiring after the second term as was custom, looked around and saw all of the accumulations of materials that he had saved throughout his life. The Roosevelts and the Delanos were savers going all the way back to the original Dutch settlers and the French Huguenots who came over. And FDR was no different. But he had amassed his papers related to his public career from when he was a New York State Senator, Assistant Secretary of the Navy during the Wilson administration, Governor of New York, and now President of the United States. FDR's administration, just to give you an example of how overwhelming the paper was that was generated by the Roosevelt administration, when he took office in March of 1933, President Hoover had only one correspondence secretary. because of the connection that Roosevelt made immediately with the American people and because of the machinery of government that was set up very quickly as a result of the first 100 days in the New Deal, the White House had to hire 70 more secretaries. Mail came into the White House at about 6,000 or 7,000 letters a day. And so the Roosevelt administration created an unprecedented amount of paper. And so as Roosevelt was getting ready to leave government after his second term, he needed some place to put all of this stuff because it was dispersed around the New York House, the Hyde Park House, and the White House. And it simply would not all fit into the basement of the Hyde Park home. So he did what any good New Dealer would do. He formed a committee. And that committee included Samuel Eliot Morison, one of the great naval historians of the time, who I believe JFK also had high regard for. The Archivist of the United States, who, by the way, FDR had appointed in 1934 when he created the National Archives, and several other prominent historians and librarians. They surveyed his collection, agreed with Roosevelt, surprise, that this was a truly unique collection that needed to be placed intact, and that the only other alternative was to disperse it to the Library of Congress, to university archives, that type of thing. So the determination was made to build a fireproof building on the estate of the Roosevelt home up in Hyde Park, where these materials could be stored and where FDR could have access to them and access to the historians who were going to learn and research about the period of the New Deal and Roosevelt's administration. But Roosevelt, one of the great political minds of our time, also knew that he couldn't just use taxpayer funds to build what would be perceived to be a monument to himself. So he created this schema where a private corporation was set up to raise money through private donations. That money would then be used to build the building on land on his estate that he would donate to the government. The building would be built to the specifications of the National Archives. Once it was completed, that building and that land would go to the government to be staffed by impartial archivists working for the archives of the United States. That was unique at the time. That is now law. That is how all presidential libraries are financed today. Presidents can build libraries should they want to, and which one is not going to want to, but they must be done in that manner. The taxpayer, you all, do not foot that bill initially for the building of the building. It is the president's donors, family, and friends who do that, but it's done to the National Archives specifications. Of course, there was no mandate that this be done, but every president after Roosevelt felt, as many presidents do, in fact, the great historian Bill Luckenberg called it in the shadow of FDR, and there were many things that FDR's shadow cast on his successors. One of them was the compulsion to donate their papers to the people of the United States. Roosevelt did so. Papers started coming to the Roosevelt Library in 1942. After Roosevelt died, of course, they came en masse. 85% of those were opened for research by 1951. That's unprecedented. Today we have 17 million pages of documents. The Clinton Library that opened a few years ago has about 78 million pages of documents and about another 80 million in electronic format. So I praise God every day that I work for an administration that used carbon paper. I don't have to deal with email. So that's how the presidential library system got set up initially. The Presidential Libraries Act of 1955 set the financing scheme in place. That's how it is today. When Richard Nixon left office, his intent was to take his papers with him, but Congress was very concerned that he would destroy evidence of criminal activity. And so they essentially did a taking under the Constitution, which is they passed a law taking Nixon's papers from him. They ultimately paid the family for the value of those. But that set in motion what became the Presidential Libraries Act of 1978, which said that beginning with the swearing-in of the president in 1981, from that point forward, records generated by the president in his official or ceremonial capacity and by those who work for him in the West Wing or in the executive office of the president, those are deemed the property of the government, not the president's personal property.
Now, could we just take that forward for a minute, since this is the subject that we're on? In 2001, just a month after 9/11, President Bush issued an executive order altered those rules so that papers could be withheld in perpetuity. Is that a proper understanding of
I'm going to answer the question to the best that I can, with the caveat, with a couple of caveats. Number one is that I work at the Roosevelt Library, and the Roosevelt Library is not subject to the Presidential Records Act. It is not part of that schema. We're under what we call deed of gifts. We are governed by other rules. Also with the caveat that I am not an expert in the Presidential Records Act. I can tell you what my understanding of it is, but I also work for the government. And as an archivist who works for the government, I want to say that our role is to preserve the records of the American people, not to challenge the laws or the executive orders or the policies that are set in place by those that are above us. We are in a position of trust. The American people have to trust us. The government has to trust us. If the government doesn't trust us to administer those records in accordance with the laws and the executive orders that we're governed by, then we as stewards of the American people can't know for sure that all of the records are coming to us. Caveat. Yeah. The Presidential Records Act essentially says that after 5 years of a president leaving office, the records of his administration are subject to the Freedom of Information Act. You as a citizen can write to the Clinton Library and say, I'm interested in seeing everything you have on the attack or the operation in Bosnia. The archivists at the Clinton Library will search the presidential records. They will identify the things that pertain to that particular subject, and then they will review those records to see if any of six restrictions that the Presidential Records Act defines are in place. One of those restrictions is the ability to not release for a period of 12 years confidential information shared between the president and his advisors. And I think Mr. Sorensen can probably agree that that isn't necessarily a bad thing, at least for a period of time, to safeguard that confidential communication between a president and his advisors. After that 12-year period runs, that particular exception can be withheld further if a president needs to claim executive privilege. That is the subject of the Reagan executive order that was put into place, as well as the Bush executive order. The Bush executive order and the Reagan executive order did not change what the Presidential Record Act defines. What it does is it indicates the machinery or the way in which a president can do a review of records that are about to be released under the Presidential Records Act, and the extent to which that privilege can be claimed.
I see.
What the Bush executive order did is it extended the period of time to give both the former president who can claim the privilege and the incumbent president, the one in office, the ability to claim that executive privilege if they need to do so. It also extended the ability to claim that executive privilege to a former president's family should he be deceased.
Well, I don't. That's very helpful, Bob, and it really sets the political agenda here. But the reason it's of deep interest to me, and I think to our other distinguished writers here, is it brings up this whole question of selectivity and memory. It brings up deeper questions of how inevitably you will only know part of the story, no matter how much of the story you know. And that's true of any kind of memoir or biography. So when you're assembling this vast archive of data, are you consciously aware of what you don't know and what you will not know, and of how, in a sense, arbitrary, however vast this accumulation of knowledge is, how it's not the whole story, could never be the whole story. Bob, I am asking you. You're free.
Well,
you have the right to not answer,
well,
I think.
Well,
ask your lawyer here.
Well, there's a certain weakness from the standpoint of a historian. First of all, when you said thank God for carbon paper, see, I thank God for carbon paper because that's what Robert Moses forgot about. when I wanted to write The Power Broker, he introduced himself to me in the following way. He said, I will never talk to you. My family will never talk to you. My friends will never talk to you. Then I forget the exact wording, but it was to the effect that anyone who ever wants a contract from New York City or New York State will never talk to you. And he said, of course, you will never see my papers, because Moses had, in something that's very akin to the executive order, somehow persuaded New York's courts that the papers of his public authorities in the Park Department were as private as the papers of a private corporation. And they were literally kept on Randall's Island. You know, his office was underneath the toll booths there. At the end of a corridor, he had a whole corridor of file cabinets, and at the end of it was an armed guard. However, one day I got a call, not to take too much time here, I got a call from someone who worked at the Park Department and said, I understand Robert Moses won't let you see his papers. And I said, that was right. She said, well, you know, he forgot about the carbon copy. And she said, the carbon copies are under the 79th Street boat basin. And now, there are three levels underneath that boat basin. And the third one is this vast garage that it was originally created to park the Park Department trucks. And when my wife Ina and I went down there for the first time with a key that this woman provided me and opened them, there against the far wall were 23 file cabinets with Robert Moses' carbon copies. But on a more serious note, there's a real problem for historians, Bob, you know, in saying that there is something that the communications between an assistant and the president can be kept closed for 12 years. And here's what the problem is from my standpoint. You want to see these communications so that you can ask them while they're still alive, what did you mean, you know? And then you can go and ask the people who are referred to in them if they are still alive. What was going on here? Lyndon Johnson used to make a lot of decisions on Vietnam at something called the Tuesday Cabinet, which is basically a lunch he had every Tuesday with McNamara, Rusk, McGeorge Bundy, and then when Bundy left, Walt Rostow, and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Earl Wheeler. And notes were kept on that, and because the Johnson Library has opened those notes, I could go to the people involved and ask them, here, you're saying this, and Rusk says this. What did you mean? What was said back and forth? You know, if you can't do that for a period of time, the first thing that happens is people die. History loses a lot. And the longer that period is extended, that's a great loss to history, in my opinion.
Well, he brings up a good point, which is I am part of what we call the mature libraries in the presidential library system, those that are pre-Presidential Records Act, and really those that are pre- probably the JFK Library would be what I would call the last of the mature libraries. It's the FDR Library, it's Truman Library, Eisenhower, and JFK. We're what we refer to as deed of gift libraries, which means that those papers are donated to us by the owner of them under a deed of gift that tells the archivists under what parameters and time frame we're able to open them, how quickly they want the family or the president wants them opened, what types of things should be restricted. And the archivists are often given a great deal of leeway in opening things unless there are particular privacy reasons. For example, and this is just a hypothetical case, assume that Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt's daughter Anna said something nasty about one of the wives of her eldest brother. Well, that woman and her children are still alive. Is it necessary to have that open at this point, or does it cause more harm than good? Those are they delegate the authority to the archivist to help to make that determination. But for the most part, deed of gift libraries, you see the records being opened quicker, and the Johnson Library is a good example of that because, for example, the LBJ tapes. Lyndon Johnson indicated that he wanted those tapes closed for 50 years or so. Yeah. But after Johnson passed away, Lady Bird Johnson, working with one of the great library directors in the history of the entire system, Harry Middleton, got together, agreed that these had such overarching historical importance that they should be opened as quickly as possible. The Johnson Library is finishing the process of doing that now. So is the Presidential Records Act ideal? That's not for me to decide. That's for you as taxpayers and your congressmen to decide right. whether or not they should do something about it.
Yeah. I didn't mean that you were, of course, the decider, simply the emblematic gatekeeper. I know people have questions. I just wanted to ask Ted before we open up the floor to them. What made you decide that this was the moment this must have been a book that you were thinking about for many, many years and preparing to write. What was the catalyst finally.
Thanks. Let me first say about the previous question that I regret the fact that the incumbent president has conducted the most secretive presidency of any in the 20th and 21st century. That's unfortunate because it hurts the country as a whole, not just the history profession. Arthur Schlesinger, Jr., before he died last year, I miss him more every month, said, history is the nation's memory. And if a nation loses its memory and doesn't know where it's been, it won't know where it's going. And that's why those presidential documents are so needed. And I fear for possibly years to come, the next president and his team are going to be finding executive orders which are never publicized, which were issued in secret, all kinds of decisions, motives, conversations, whether political or not, which have never been publicized. Every administration is entitled to some confidentiality. I realize that. I used to say that a new proposal or idea in its infancy may not be strong enough to stand on its infant legs out in the cold blast and is entitled to be introduced to the public only when it has been fully developed and can remain confidential until then. But everything else, I've worked for one of the most open presidents in the history of the country. Not only did he have a wide-ranging press conference every 2 weeks, but he also made certain that as much was conveyed to the press, he even had an official historian, Arthur, on staff, and so that helped make my job easier. I decided to write the book. And you're right, I had been thinking about it for some time, lamenting the fact that I was always too overwhelmed with too many other duties during my 11 years with Kennedy that I did not take notes, did not keep diaries. I tried it one day and found that at the end of the day I was trying to repeat everything I had worked on in writing during the day to write it again. It meant twice as long a day, and it just my days were already too long. But I had thought about it, and a good historian who is now the director of the Nixon Library, ironically, came to see me when he was at the Miller Center for the Presidency, where he was in charge of transcribing the Kennedy tapes. Kennedy, like a lot of other presidents, including Roosevelt, made a lot of tapes, in part because he wanted it for history purposes. He intended to write a book at the end of his public service. So this historian brought me an extraordinary tape. I mention it, I think, in the book, in which Kennedy was contemplating, because of his dissatisfaction with the work product of the State Department, moving his national security advisor, Mac Mundy, brilliant human being who served in Johnson's White House as well, moving him to the State Department and placing me as replacing him with me as National Security Advisor. And so he brought me this transcript to see if I could guess or tell him who might else have been in the room, because the recordings don't reveal who else is taking part in a conversation. I could not guess. But I was overwhelmed by that piece of news which I had never known about. I had never known that Kennedy contemplated that move. My whole life might have changed if I had been made National Security Advisor during his last year in office. And the historian said, the history community knows a lot about Kennedy and his contribution to this country. We know quite a bit about your contribution to Kennedy, but we don't know anything about you. Where did you come from? Your ideas, your ideals. Where did you learn all of this? He said, I'd like to come up here if you'll take 3 days off from your law practice, and I'd like to interview you on tape for 3 straight days. And then I said, will you give me a copy? And he said, yes, of course. And I said, that's a good idea. I will do that if I can ever find 3 days to do it. At that time, my law practice was very, very busy. The next day, I had a stroke that took away the effective use of my eyes. And I decided if I can write, I better try to write that book while I still have some memory and some writing skills left. And I worked on it for 6 straight years.
Ted, well, it's very good that you did. We're very fortunate that you did. We only have a few minutes. I know people want to have questions. So why don't we raise your hands and I will... Do you have a microphone? Yes, sir.
Is there any requirement for preservation and publication or availability of the papers of the vice president? It could be important in this administration.
Good luck. Who's going to answer that question?
The Presidential Records Act actually does include the vice president in its mandates.
So there.
I'll just say if it's Joe Biden, you're going to have some very lengthy documents. And if it's not, there won't be any at all.
Others? Yes.
For Mr. Caro,
yes.
What overwhelms me about the scope of the work that you did is just the sheer research of it. I imagine you have researchers who assist you, first question. Second of all, when you start a new project like the LBJ book, do you have an idea of where you're going as you get started, or do you let the papers sort of guide you along?
Yeah, that's a terrific question. I don't, in fact, have teams of researchers. A lot of historians have 4 or 5 researchers. In my whole life, there's only been one person that I ever trusted to do research for me, and she's been the whole team, my wife, Ina Caro. Would you stand up for a second? But, you know, your other question, which really is, I learned when I was writing The Power Broker that I couldn't really start to outline the book. I do all the try to do all the research, because that's really not true, because as you get into each chapter, you realize that that file you didn't bother looking at the library was really the heart of it, so you have to go back. But I try to do the bulk of the research before I ever start writing, and I really can't write the book I found until I know what the last sentence is. Like, the last sentence of The Power Broker is, "Why weren't they grateful?" which is something I heard Robert Moses say. And up to that time, I had really been stuck. I had done all this research, and I couldn't think of how I wanted the book, you know, how I was going to put it all into a book. And he was in retirement then, you know, and he was giving this speech, and he was just enraged at the lack of public appreciation for him. And he said, "Why?" And it's a line from his speech, "Why aren't they grateful?" You know. And in that moment, I knew exactly how I was going to do the book, to try to show why new people of New York should be grateful to him, and why there was another side.
Yeah. Well,
that's very interesting.
What's interesting is that different biographers write and research in different ways. You know, Mr. Caro just said that he likes to do the research before he starts writing. Gene Edward Smith, who just wrote a fantastic biography of FDR that came out about a year ago, actually does it a different way. He actually decides how many chapters the biography is going to be, and then divides his subject's life into that number of chapters. And then he will research and write only that specific chapter of the person's life. And he does it on longhand foolscap paper, you know, legal pad paper, but he only deals with that particular chapter at a time, so that by the end of his exercise, he's got all the chapters of the book essentially in final form.
Can you imagine working that way?
No.
Yes.
How about the first ladies?
Are what about them?
By the act?
Actually, no, they're not, because they're not considered to be government employees. You know, the first ladies donate their papers to the libraries. Eleanor Roosevelt's papers, for example, total about 3 million pages, covering her early life. They're really split into two parts, covering her early life through April 12th of 1945, and then everything for her 17 years of post-White House career. But certainly the first ladies donate through deed of gift their papers to the libraries as well.
Anyone else? Actually, I'd like to tell a story myself or offer a description of Bob's working methods that I encountered in Master of the Senate, which I've been reading. And it gave me as vivid a sense of his working methods and of the kind of dedication that's required to write a book of this magnitude. So perhaps we should just conclude with my telling of this story. This is when you were trying to determine how tall, not just how tall LBJ was, but what it was like when he stood over the podium in the Senate and what it felt like for all those around him to be beneath this looming tower. And as it happened, correct me if I'm making forgetting something here, but Bill Bradley was in the Senate that day. And Bob, like a painter, said, Senator Bradley, could you just go over and stand by the podium there? And didn't you sort of urge him to lean in a certain way so that because Bradley was about the same height as Johnson, and so Bradley agreed and stood there for a while, and then began to wonder how long do you have to stand there, right? And it became clear that Bob wasn't finished drinking in this visual impression that he needed in order to convey literally the stature of your subject. And when I read that, I thought, this is how a biographer should really work. So I hope that our next president, whoever that may be, will be as fortunate in having as talented and brilliant a advisor and writer as JFK had in Ted Sorensen, and I hope that he will have as great and inspired a biographer as Robert Caro. So thank you very much for being here tonight.
Thank you. That was a terrific story.